I think that any discussion of our euphemistically titled criminal justice system today generally focuses on some kind of changing of the old for the new, though we can only hope for as good a deal as the fellow got for his wife. But the notion of change in our criminal justice system seems to underlie most current concern about it. In a more serious tone, then, if we really are to consider changing this system or its apparatus, then I think a brief paragraph from Niccolo Machiavelli, the prince, might be in order, which he said that it must be remembered that there is nothing more difficult to plan, more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to manage than the creation of a new system. For the initiator has the enmity of all who would profit by the preservation of the old institution, and merely lukewarm defenders in those who would gain by the new one. The hesitation of the latter arises in part from their fear of adversaries who have the laws on their side, and in part from the general skepticism of mankind, which does not really believe in an innovation until experience proves its value. So it happens that whenever his enemies have occasion to attack the innovator, they do so with the passion of partisans, while the others defend him sluggishly, so that the innovator and his party are alike vulnerable. Just by way of comment, then, those of you who may have been concerned or indignant in the last few years about bodies in Arkansas or explosions in Ohio or shots in New York may wonder then why more has not ensued as a result of these terrible occasions. It is true, I think, that the system for many years has protected its malingerers and its mistakes, and that those certainly who would improve the system are welcome, but those who would attack it are attacked themselves by partisans and only sluggishly defended by their defenders. Because, after all, much of the real heart blood of the American system is at stake here. And the American system includes some of our mistakes as well as some of our greatest strengths. Now, if I may presume for a moment on your program planner's intentions in devising this program, I would say that it was not idle curiosity or even the purity of a scholarly purpose that caused them to tailor the theme and activities of this day to the criminal justice system. Rather, I suppose, there may have been a commonly shared, though in most cases less commonly acted upon, sense of indignation at the injustice within our system apparatus, police, courts, corrections, and some kind of a fundamental discomfiture at the failure of these institutionalized efforts to reduce crime and its attendant pain to tolerable levels. Notice I do not say eliminate crime, as I will expand a little bit later. If then this concern about reducing the problem is at the base of the reason why you're here to talk about the criminal justice system rather than simply wanting to know about it, then what can we do, in fact, to reduce the discomfiture that we feel, or even the moral indignation or the plain outrage, as the case may be? Then I think first we should know what crime is, if I may treat you for a moment like a class, since That's probably what I know how to do best, whether it's right or wrong. Let's look at the dictionary. Crime is an act of omission in violation of public law, either forbidding or commanding it, for which a punishment is prescribed and which is prosecuted by the state in its own name or the name of the people or the sovereign. Second definition, any grave offense against morality or the social order. That's about it. 2 points I'd like to make about that definition briefly. First place, crime is something that is defined by law in the formalistic sense. Not perhaps law in the genuine historical or theological sense, but statutes, codes, and laws as they exist on the books of our communities, our cities, our counties, and our states. The second point I would like to make is that the definition of crime and by extension criminal law does not bear major responsibility for the definition of or the primary defense of morality and the enforcement of morality for the community. It does, as the dictionary says, concern itself and has indeed for at least a couple of hundred years, concern itself with grave offenses against morality. Whether or not that means marijuana smoking, whether a grave offense against morality anymore is adultery or even promiscuity, whether or not times may not have changed so that what constituted in the minds of lawmakers at one point grave offenses against morality of the social order any longer do. Notice I am not saying that those are not offenses against morality, or that a prostitution may not be an offense against morality. The question is whether or not it constitutes a grave offense against morality in the social order. Now, what is the criminal justice system? I'll give you a very brief sketch over of it. At base, it includes the causes of crime, that is, those primary causes of crime. Notice I do not say causes of criminality, but causes of acts of crime. And I make a distinction here. I think probably much of our confusion in our criminal justice system, in the minds of our people, our teachers, our policemen, has to do somehow with stamping out criminality in people. It goes all the way back to Lombroso, in which it was thought for many generations, and indeed now among the public, that somehow criminals partake of criminality and are somehow different than others. This goes against the complete logic of the dictionary definition of crime as something that's simply against the law, not something that has anything to do with the inherent nature of the committer of the crime. Perhaps crime, criminality indeed, has to do with human nature, but whether or not it has to do with any special criminal nature or not, I doubt. The criminal act is a fact, however. It's against the law, it's an act that is defined by law and is subject to sanction, punishment. And somehow we do have causes in society of criminal acts. Now, I don't want to bore you about socioeconomic conditions, sociocultural deprivation, breakdown in families, breakdown indeed in the church as a socializing agency, breakdown indeed in the school, in the ghetto situations where it's no longer able even to police its own halls. These are causes of criminal acts. Lack of prevention activities, despite the fact that we know one of the most numerous crimes in the United States is that of taking cars. We still don't have a decent car law, nor do we have any uniform protection of their vehicles by consumers with what is available to them. Instead, we have almost a complete divorcement of responsibility in the public community for crime acts, somehow excused by the fact that we have believed for many years in criminality that inheres in the individual. Let us now get rid of that nonsense and talk about the causes of crime acts. All right, the next step, that's part of the criminal justice system, those things, if there is indeed a system. If we're going to talk about it, let's include everything. The next step are prevention, understanding, service, and policing activities, and the future in which all of these things will be brought together under policing or law enforcement type activities. Next are the courts and the marvelous apparatus that processes people through courts. I don't know, Mr. Siebold, did you make up any of those sheets? You didn't? You did get those. You got the big one, but not the, that's the only one, right? Yeah. Well, you can follow this on that sheet, although it's considerably more detailed. I won't go into all those details unless perhaps in the questioning period you want to. The court and the system of the administration of justice comes next. Next is prisons, probation, and all the diversions and alternatives, jails, that are available by way of depriving the liberty of an individual as a sanction or punishment. And then finally, parole, aftercare, and reintegration into the social fabric of the country. Now, each of these are characterized by faults as they presently operate. Confusion of roles, lack of definition of purpose, and extreme public pressure characterize the policing function today. Courts and the system of justice are plagued by delays, by inefficiencies, by overload. In fact, in the lower district of Manhattan, where I recently sat through a night court session, I would say that system is practically speaking bankrupt. It is simply overloaded. It does not have the efficient tools. They're still writing down offenses in great big books, and they have thousands of people waiting in the tombs to be processed. Public defenders meet their clients 2 to 5 minutes before they go to trial, and the den in which they must interview and process, make decisions in order to do to plea on behalf of their client is so confusing as to make it almost impossible. And law students or barely graduated law students are doing the job. Prisons rehabilitate in name only. In general, even though they are supposed to be rehabilitation institutions, it's variously estimated that of the million people under the custody of correctional institutions in any one day, that 90% of the effort and the budget and so on is spent in maintaining custody and not in carrying out rehabilitative activities. So that the system that we have, if it is a system, really consists of separately operating apparatus which have within themselves criminogenic seeds. That is, they produce crime in many cases instead of rehabilitating or preventing further crime. We might make an analogy to a hospital which is elaborately designed. And I suppose if we were really to make an analogy to a hospital, we would have to have a hospital where we had the diagnosis, the prevention activity, the diagnosis and emergency ward room would be separate, under a separate administration and separated geographically and philosophically from the actual treatment facilities themselves. And finally, we'd have the treatment facilities in another place, and so on, and the aftercare and the recuperative facilities in another place yet under another administration. If we carry that analogy still further, and if you've been in many prisons, jails, not without notable exceptions, but if you've been in many of them, I say in many places, you will find they're unsterile. Or at least, if we use the analogy, they're like doctors using unsterile instruments that promote infection instead of curing infection, that may cure one problem by depriving liberty, but in fact is still another problem. Segregation of diseases is inadequate. We throw people together still in many jails. We throw people together without regard for offense, background, and even age in prisons to some extent. As a consequence, our prisons become places where people are infected, in fact, by further alienation, not alienation as a part of criminality, but alienation as a part of a real feeling of being unwanted, undesired, and mad at, in fact, society. Now, what then shall be the object of our reflection today? Just a polemic of this kind? No, certainly not. But to set the stage for you, I think those things, if not, you know, are fair, if not entirely pleasing. I would suggest that today, unlike my classes, I guess, we're not going to really be able to dissect, analyze, discuss. What we're going to have to do is just stick, maybe settle for a point of view with regard to the criminal justice system and settle, hopefully, upon some object. I would suggest three, as far as I'm concerned. What I'll try to do for you, talk about what we should do if we would reduce crime. Two, because after all, why do I say reduce crime when we're talking about the criminal justice system? Why don't we take crime as a given and go ahead and deal with it as we can? Because I would suggest that the criminal justice system itself will never do much to reduce crime. The whole apparatus of police, at least their law enforcement control catching function, that's not including other roles that they should and in some cases are assuming, but their law enforcement catching function, the courts and their function, and the prisons and rehabilitative institutions and all the parole, aftercare, etc. None of these things will in fact reduce very much crime. In fact, the better they work, we may be amazed to see that crime continues to go up, depending upon the philosophy and the push toward making them work, or that is the sources of the push toward making them work. No, crime somehow is back there in the act of crime is back there in the community, and those causes that have to do with the disorganization in the community. And it'll go right on no matter how efficiently we deal with it. There are some ways, though, to reduce crime that I'll allude to. Second, we should be concerned about injustice in the system itself, because we should be, and I think are, concerned about justice. We should be concerned about doing what we say we're doing, rehabilitating, or that is delivering justice in the court, protecting people, giving service for the police, and rehabilitating for corrections and reintegrating for parole and aftercare. We should be concerned about improving the efficiency and the effectiveness. And finally, I think we should now become concerned about something that may not seem to some people to be part of a criminal justice program, but we should be concerned about restoring morality and the social order without asking the criminal law to do it.
core, we should be concerned about relegating to its proper agency concerns about morality and the social order, and leaving to the criminal law its primary function of protecting the property, person, and rights of one person from another. It doesn't mean protecting his moral conscience at all. Now, what do we do then if we want to reduce crime, and in fact then perhaps at least place into receivership this bankruptcy of the criminal justice system? Maybe one word about that. You don't have the other little chart that I sent. But if you were able to lay on top of your chart a flow chart of numbers being processed through that system, on the left where you have the initial apprehensions by police, we might say in any given year that there would be about 3 million, this is for the federal system. There would be about 2,700,000 arrests take place there. And at the end, where they're spewed in, where they're sentenced after the court procedure and go into the prison system, there would be about 65,000. Somewhere between that initial arrest and sentencing, we lose 98% or 99% of the offenders, or the probable offenders, not all guilty, to be sure. Many of them, of course, are never even arrested. That is, those initial apprehensions are never charged. They may be detained, they may be investigations, and so on. Many of them are diverted from the system through mediating, adjustment, or other kinds of systems. Many of them go into court and are rejected in court by nolle pros, by dismissal, by lack of evidence, so on. Of those who go on to the system, there are still other diversions before they may finally be sentenced either to probation or to prison. And then more go to probation than to prison. So we're really dealing with a system that is handling far too many offenses to handle any of them very well. A suggestion that I subscribe to, and Norval Morris and Gordon Hawkins in their book, An Honest Politician's Guide to Crime Control, bear part responsibility for some of my statement at least, if not the thinking involved, that a major way to reduce crime is to decriminalize a lot of the offenses that now participate in primarily protecting the morals rather than the person, property, or rights of others. Notable among these kinds of offenses are gambling, the use of unlawful substances, if not including perhaps their distribution, control, prostitution, sex offenses, and perhaps several others, certain kinds of sex offenses. We might at least then confine, if we are not willing to go all that way, we might at least confine and redefine the law to deal only with those offenses in that area that are of grave nature, and let the rest be handled by the social order, the family, the church, the community organization, and the recreational structure. Second, we need to have standing committees, and in the beginning, probably wholesale reviews of criminal law with regard to, first, the scope of the criminal law itself, to confine it to those offenses which do in fact have to do with protecting the person, property, and rights of others. Second, to review the sanctions involved in the criminal law, to remove those unenforceable sanctions. One of the most important theorists in the country has said that the criminal law sanctions, of course, actually came from English law primarily. We now have also, incidentally, the longest sentencing practices in the United States courts of any country in the world. Europe's sentencing practices are, practically speaking, half of ours, continental Europe. And for murder, much less than that. The average sentence served for murder in Scandinavia is less than 6 years. But we have heavy sanctions. Many of them are, in fact, unenforceable. That is, they do not produce the deterrent effect that they were designed to produce, partly because we are now in the process of having to invoke them. It's like the parent who says to his child, if you do that again, I'm going to beat the hell out of you. Now, if the kid does it, you know, you're in trouble. I mean, it's okay as long as it's a threat. If that stops him and it works, fine. But if you've got to follow through, you're in trouble, you see. Now we're in the position, you see, of having a bunch of heavy sanctions in the law to provide deterrent effects. By golly, we're being called and they don't work. They won't work if people don't ignore them, or if they're willing to accept that sanction, or if they don't care, or if they're crazy, or if they're under the influence or something. So that, not that sanctions will not always be required, but they need to be more scientifically designed. We need to remove outmoded concepts of deterrence, have a thoroughgoing study of our theory of deterrence that is at least systematic, if not scientific. For instance, our law presumes that a fine as an alternative to a prison sentence means the same thing to me as it does to the president of, shall we say, ITP, or that it does to the poorest Chicano in Gallup, New Mexico. This simply ain't true. $500 fine to the ITP guy is nothing. To me, it's going to bother me a day or two. To the Chicano and Gallup, he can't pay it, so he goes to jail. A jail sentence to the Chicano and Gallup may be uncomfortable, but may not change his life or his community standing that much. For me, it would be disaster, you see. I'd lose my job, probably. I might even lose my family, or at least I would lose my friends, probably. It would be also disastrous, and perhaps more so for president of ITP. So what does that mean? It means that if you put that $500 or 6 months on an offense, going to deter one of us more than the other, and also we're going to see what our influence can do toward making it a fine in the case of myself and the ITP and guy rather than a prison sentence, and the reverse on the other end. Okay. And then finally, the decriminalization and repeat the object of good social discourse and community and civilization is, and its agencies, the family, the church, government, is to provide for us a good life. Now the object of our criminal justice system within this is only to provide the conditions necessary so that the other parts of our life and lead toward the good life, if you will, to provide a precondition of good order. The good order is not the good life. Plato made them somewhat equivalent, but held indeed the good life to be a somewhat higher character than good order, but connected to it. But I'm not even sure anymore that we know how much they are connected. The object of the law is to provide order so that I will need not fear for my person, property, or basic guaranteed rights. You won't get in my way. That doesn't give me the good life. I can still be miserable, you know, and all kinds of things. But don't put on the criminal law devising a good life. So that if we decriminalize, if we study the sanction and deterrent effects of the law and revise the law by delimiting it, by revising its sanctions, and third, if we let the law do what it can do and the criminal justice system do what it might be able to do and leave the rest to more appropriate agencies, we'll be better off. All right, those are, you know, scientific-type solutions. There is a simpler solution. Guy Tardy, French philosopher, said, crime is the price we pay for social progress. That may be true. If it is true, and if history, and indeed comparative criminology in this day and age make any sense, there may be a simpler solution if you want to pay the price. As it may be almost a total solution to crime that you can reach, could we obtain agreement and a government that would do it almost immediately. That is, that we simply replace our present democratic participative representative republican type government with an oligarchy or a dictatorship, probably an oligarchy. That we tear down our assembly line and our production machinery, and we substitute a feudal economy in which small groups of people under the head of a sub-dictator or oligarch control the economic means of production in small units and singly own the state. That we then say to each child that's coming up that you get and you need and you will have, in any case, no more education than is required for you to do the job that your father is now doing. And that any more than that would be unthinkable, impossible, and impertinent of you to think about. That we would have no more social welfare program because it's not working very well anyway, and its owners. That we instead say families take care of their own, and fathers, mothers, grandfathers, cousins, uncles, etc., stick together. And if you don't take care of your own, you're no damn good family, and we don't care. And the fit will survive, and those who take care of themselves will survive, and the rest of you won't. We eliminate all this extensive criminal justice system, all these judges, courtrooms, buildings, jails, etc., and we don't do even very much punishing. But when we do punish, we make it severe, and we make it unpredictable and capricious. Don't laugh. Talk to your psych professor. Learning theory has it, you know, that if a girl is learning to play the piano, you give her a quarter every day for practicing an hour. The imprint or the behavioral modification is not as great as if you give her $5 every 30th time on an unpredictable or capricious basis. That means that will teach her to play, to practice better than it will to give her a quarter every time, even though she gets a third less money at the end. It's because $5 means a lot of money. That really, really digs in. A quarter every day gets pretty old. All right. You can look around the world now. Southeast Asia, until very recently, for instance, had very little crime. Some Oriental countries had very little crime. They had this kind of structure. There may yet be countries in South America or Africa, developing countries, where these conditions persist and there is very little official crime. There may be injustice, but there won't be muggings on the street. You know, that would be dangerous. One, it would, by reducing aspiration, you reduce the desire to change your condition and hence the aggression inherent in it. Okay, I want to wrap this up in about 5 minutes and give you a chance for us to have some discussion with the distinguished reactors who are here and perhaps for you to ask some questions. So we have said then that crime should be, in order for crime to be reduced to tolerable level, if Tardy was right that crime is part of the progress we pay for, price we pay for social progress, if in fact aspiration, education, movement, democracy, attention to the right sometimes produces a certain amount of discord, and one of my main theses is that half of juvenile delinquency in this country is perfectly normal behavior, normal testing behavior. It wouldn't happen in that oligarchical feudal society. They'd be scared to do it and hence would never mature properly. But in our society, a part of maturing properly is to be able to engage in some testing. In certain communities, this testing is against the law because of the norms and standards or the anomie or normlessness that exists in those communities. But it's still perfectly normal behavior. That doesn't mean we shouldn't enforce the law, but it means we should be fairly sensible about how we do it because they're really engaging in normal behavior. So what we're really talking about is reducing crime to tolerable levels given the pace at which we want to move in our society. There's a trade-off involved, and maybe we should move slower and have less time. Maybe the price we pay is too great, but maybe we should be willing to tolerate some crime. By the decriminalization and by the removal of opportunity and through prevention and by a study of criminal law, and then finally that we relegate two other socializing agencies in our communities, the defense of public morality, and leave the law to those questions, harming person, property, and rights. Now then, finally, what can we do about the system? Well, one of the problems with the system is that it is not a system, as I've said before. It's separately operating apparatus with using where its practitioners and its professionals are using sterile instruments. One of the things we probably ought to be concerned about in the primary instance is thinking about developing a system, an interface between police, courts, and corrections. In order and articulation of their activities with the needs of the public, including the needs of offenders, begin to develop this articulation. John Stuart Mill, of course, said that the power of government over any of its citizens should be limited. That is, the power of government, not its authority, but its power should be limited to the deprivation of liberty as the utmost sanction that's within its power. We may be approaching this in our modern American civilization as we begin to consider, at least, the removal of capital punishment. However, in practice, that isn't what we do. We do a lot more to people. We heap enormous indignities on people, such small things as being unwilling to notify a cell occupant that we are going to search his cell for contraband, being unwilling to give him a list of what we took when we leave, or being unwilling even indeed to straighten the cell up. These are small things, and things that good professional correctional practitioners will tell you are okay. We don't have time to do that. We don't have time to pay attention to how that guy feels about looking for contraband. We don't have time to notify him. In fact, we'd rather do it when he's at work and doesn't know we're going to do it. Then we might get more. But when not too long ago, an inmate came back into his cell in one of the largest federal institutions and simply stabbed a guard to death because he was infuriated by what had been done to his cell. This still didn't seem to get the lesson home. He was labeled dangerous, deranged. Maybe he was. He was deranged. There's no question about that. But then a lot of us get deranged sometime. And then we finally need systematic and scientific examination of these laws and their deterrent effects. I did not really have the time to go over the system as it operates in detail, but perhaps there are books available to you. I would suggest primarily a big book you can buy for $2.25 done by the President's Commission on Crime in the United States called The Challenge of Crime in a Free Society. You get more reading there for $2.25 than you can on any paperback bookstand. It's a big, fat, wide book. It will tell you about how the system operates in all detail. Second book I recommend to you that's entertaining and easy to read is Morrison Hawkins' Honest Politician's Guide to Crime Control. And for those of you who want to be honest politicians, it might even be pragmatically useful in a book you'd like to keep. Another recent book that's just out in the last few weeks, published by NIMH and sells only for $1, by Clarence Schrag on Criminal Justice American Style, points up both deficiencies, history, theory, and a few solutions for the criminal justice system, as well as having some excellent bibliographies that will point you where to go after that. So with that, I close and thank you for your very kind attention.
I don't basically disagree with anything that Dr. Matthews said in terms of the confusion of the justice system, and I share a lot of the same feelings that he has. So in order to be productive, I thought, and make the most contribution, what I would do is I would single out a few specifics from his comments and maybe expand and in one instance disagree. Throughout the presentation, Dr. Matthews referred to corrections as being responsible for rehabilitation, in being accountable to the public for changing the people that come into the system. And it's on that point that I find that I must disagree. I think it's also my feeling that, you know, forces me to disagree, that makes me say, even though I've worked in corrections for 11 years, I do not consider myself a corrections man, especially an institutional man. I find that to work in corrections, one must be almost schizophrenic. Your training, your quote-unquote profession, tells you to change, to rehabilitate, to correct. On the other hand, when you look at what the community holds the correction man accountable for, what he gets his gold stars on his reports cards for, it's not correction rehabilitation at all, but rather it's safety, security, and peace and quiet. If I don't have any escapes, if I don't have any disorders in the jail, I get a gold star on my report card. If I have any disturbances in the jail, if I have any escapes, I'm on page one of the Globe and the Post. Sunday, I have a graduation of a county jail, the only county jail in Missouri that has educational programs and vocational training programs, we graduate 13 people with their high school diplomas, and this brings our total for the year, for the last 12 months, up to 102 people. And we end up on page 10. We get 5 telephone calls to the supervisor's office complaining that we're wasting taxpayers' money on these people when good kids in the community aren't getting their just share of the tax dollar. Now, I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter at all, and I'm not complaining. All I'm saying is, you know, there's a certain schizophrenic definition in this whole crazy thing of the correction system, and I'm not really sure the community wants us to correct as much as punish. I think if you read the laws, the sentences, if you talk with most of the people in the justice system, they see the role of correction as one of punishment and not change and not correction. Needless to say, with my background and my opening comments, I don't subscribe to that. I feel that my role is one of correction. But I think in terms of the criminal justice system, one of the things that we need desperately is a clear definition of what the hell we're supposed to be doing. Because it is correct that we're spending 80% to 90% of the dollar that correction gets in custody and control. And that isn't necessarily keeping a decent place to keep these people as much as it is to buy the carbines and the guard towers and the people that surround the perimeter to keep them inside. Let's look at what is inside. Dr. Matthews referred to it as decriminalizing. I have got 2 very practical experiences, and working in the field, I feel I must be practical with you and give you things to relate to. Washington, D.C. did a very interesting study on victimless crime. They took 6 Skid Row alcoholics whose only offense was drunk in public, and they studied their history of exposure or involvement in the justice system. These 6 people accounted for over 1,400 arrests. These 1,400 arrests and adjudications cost the taxpayers in the Washington, D.C. area over $600,000. That's a lot of money to spend on a drunk. You know? And that's his only problem, is he drinks too much. I hold that, you know, the criminal justice system, which is a very expensive system, is not the place for these people to be worked with. This is a problem for your social agency. This is a problem for some other community agency who can do the job much better. What is corrections treatment of that revolving door alcoholic? I think the East St. Louis jail in the drunk tank is a good example, because they're one of the local areas that still use the Saturday evening drunk tank, where everyone is put in together, you know, and Monday morning we just take the hoses in and wash the vomit down the drain. Another example of the justice system in the area of decriminalization of some of these offenses is in our own state of Missouri here. It costs you and I $124 for the state of Missouri to issue a traffic ticket to a person going 80 miles an hour in a 70 mile an hour zone. And for that $124 expenditure, we collect on the average of a $22 fine. And again, I must, you know, agree with Dr. Matthews, and the National Council on Crime and Delinquency has published many research studies that have systematized knowledge in terms of the effect of sentencing on the deterrence of crime. I feel that we need, desperately to look at this whole area of criminal justice in terms of risk management, and do away with some of the old wives' tales that we've been dealing with for years, get the victimless crime out of the justice system, begin to provide training for people, look at what we call traditional role. I'm not sure that the judge is the most qualified person to sentence. No. He's certainly the most trained of all the members of the justice system, but he's trained in law. And being trained in law is a long way from being trained in how to deal with people. Because most lawyers that I come into contact with are more interested in the game of defense and prosecution than they are in what happens to the individual person who comes into the justice system.
Dr. Matthews mentioned in the course of his speech that the criminal justice system does not reduce crime. And regrettably, it seems that that observation is accurate. We like to think that the police are going to reduce crime by presumably stopping people from committing them before they have an opportunity to do so. But we know that that's simply not the case. We expect, perhaps even more hopefully, that the correction system will reduce crime by reforming those who are subjected to it. However, we have little reason to believe that that is the case. In fact, many of the crimes that are committed by those who have at one time been in a jail or a prison. And it seems to me that we have a dilemma here, and that is that we know the people, some of the people anyhow, who are going to commit new crimes. We know who they are. We don't have to go out and try to identify them. They're the people who are in today's jails and today's prisons. But we know that what we're doing for them now is not going to really make any difference. I'm not sure that the correctional system can, in any event, make a difference in people's lives, that is, by substantially changing their behavior. Dr. Matthews suggested that we would have to go back to the community in order to really try to find the sources of crime, and perhaps that is accurate. I'm not sure that at this point we can say. But in any event, it seems to me that it is clear that we must, as Dr. Matthews suggested, provide justice for those who are in the system. Even if we can't rehabilitate them, if we don't really know what to do, at the most, or at the least, I should say, we must provide them with justice. And at this point, in many instances, we are not. I'd like to review just briefly the day of an inmate in a typical prison and suggest some of the difficulties with which he is presented and some of the things which lead him to react in the way that inmates often do react. The inmate gets up in the morning and is usually subjected first to a count. This means he essentially gets up and stands oftentimes in front of his cell, sometimes inside of his cell, and a guard comes down and counts each one of the inmates to determine that they're there. They've got to stand at attention for a given period of time, most of the time without speaking to the person on the left or the person on the right. After that, the inmate is marched to breakfast. Typically, during the time that he is going to his meal, he is not permitted to carry on any conversation. He's marched in order. He doesn't walk in a casual fashion as the rest of us do. When he arrives, oftentimes, at least in maximum security institutions, he is in a large room which has essentially rows of what look like something like that lectern, only a little bit lower, and he sits down on what amounts to a stool and is given the food. While he is eating, he is permitted to talk to the person on the left and the person on his right, but not to the person in front or the person in back. The food is sometimes adequate, sometimes inadequate, but eating is not a very pleasurable experience in a prison. After that, he is again marched in order, sometimes back to his cell and other institutions, to his workstation. The work is typically very, very tedious. It's not hard. It's not hard. People in prison do not work, for the most part, very diligently. In fact, they try to do as little as they can. But the work is boring and monotonous, and this takes place all morning. At noon, he's marched back to eat in the same fashion in which I described during the breakfast. After lunch, he is again marched back to his workstation. He works until about 3 o'clock. In some instances, he is then marched for dinner. They usually eat dinner very, very early in prisons because all the civilian help wants to be done is cleaning up the place and sent back home or back at their homes before 5 o'clock. So the inmate is then taken for his evening meal, again under the same conditions. After that, he may be permitted a half an hour recreation. He may be run out into the yard for an opportunity, providing it's not winter and too cold to go outside. After that, he's put back in his cell, and there he stays again until the following morning. On weekends, sometimes it's worse because you don't have the interruption of work. The inmate is required to stay in his in his cell, rather, for the period of time. The inmate is not permitted to have many contacts on the outside. He is restricted in the communications which he can have. He's typically permitted to write 3 or 4 letters and perhaps one letter per week to 3 or 4 friends or family. Now, these friends are screened by the social worker. The purpose of this, presumably, is to put him in contact only with desirable people. The contents of his letters are read, and if he makes any remarks adverse about the institution, those remarks are deleted. He's not permitted to send the letter. He's often not permitted access to the media. He has a complaint. He is not permitted to send letters to newspapers, television stations, or what have you, although there's been some change in this recently. The inmate is subjected to disciplinary proceedings during our disciplinary action during the course of his stay in the prison, which can result from practically anything which he does inside the institution. The rules are typically very, very vague. They're not spelled out in any way. Rather, they're passed on from inmate to inmate out in the yard or from the guard to the inmate during the course of his stay in the institution. If the guard objects to something done by the inmate, he can what's called write him up, and usually the guard has substantial authority to do this. Typically, the guard then is called to a disciplinary hearing. Sometimes there's only one hearing officer. The guard reads his report. Inmate X was impertinent during the time he was in the workshop. He made an uncomplimentary remark, or he was fighting with inmate Y, or he was refusing to work, or whatever it might have been at the time. Or he perhaps was talking in line while they were marching to the meal, or he was talking to the guy behind him, or whatever, any number of different problems. Typically, then, the inmate is permitted to respond to this, and he does so by giving whatever explanation he has. Perhaps he denies it. But in any event, then, the disciplinary officer acts and decides to take whatever course he thinks is appropriate. It is very, very unusual for the disciplinary officer to decide that, in fact, the inmate was right and the guard was wrong, for very obvious reasons, I suppose. It's considered to be important to maintain the authority of the guard and to not permit the inmate to prevail. The inmates typically have not been permitted to ask questions of the guard, to bring other evidence, and so on. The point of all this is that I think in prisons today, although there are some exceptions, we have not even yet achieved what we could call justice or a humane kind of living condition, to say nothing of providing a sort of an atmosphere which is rehabilitative. It seems to me perfectly obvious that you can't rehabilitate someone while you're holding them and hitting them in the face at the same time. You just you can't intend to injure someone and at the same time hope that he's going to be rehabilitated. But first, I think we ought to make an effort to achieve justice. You may have read in the newspapers recently that lawyers and judges have become increasingly involved in the prison system. For many, many years, the attitude of the courts was that they would not become involved in the internal operations of the prison. And this was phrased as a hands-off doctrine. It was the guiding principle upon which courts acted. However, certain events which occurred in prisons, primarily in Arkansas and some other jurisdictions, led the court to change this attitude. They were just unwilling to defer to the discretion of the penal authority. This is not surprising, obviously, when the bodies are discovered on the prison yard. It seems that were somewhat beyond discretion. But in any event, this movement gained some momentum, and it became concerned with the things which were less than death. One area which was of substantial concern to lawyers is disciplinary proceedings themselves and the punishment which can ensue from being disciplined. Obviously, it is very, very important to the inmate whether he is found to be in violation of some disciplinary rule and is punished. Typically, punishment in an institution consists of being confined to solitary for an extended period of time. In some instances, this period of time extended beyond 100 days to 150 days and so on. The courts initially were willing to upset that sort of action on the part of the prison authorities. The prison authorities had come to rely too much, and by their own admission, upon disciplinary solitary confinement as a technique for dealing with inmates. And as the longer the inmates stayed in the solitary confinement, the more intractable they became. The courts have been willing to intervene in these instances and set certain limits upon the time which a person can be held in a solitary confinement cell. Similarly, the courts have made some effort to provide at least the semblance of a disciplinary hearing. The inmate should be entitled to have an independent panel. Previously, it had been common for the prison to have the guard who made the initial arrest, if you will, or the initial report, sitting on the panel. Well, obviously, this is inconsistent with the idea of having an independent hearing examiner. We now have rules in some litigation suggesting, or holding rather, that it's necessary to have an independent panel. Similarly, the inmates are typically now entitled to, in some jurisdictions, bring witnesses, bring other inmates who may have something to contribute about the incident. As we know, typically every incident has a number of factors which contribute to it, some important and some unimportant. The inmate's now permitted to bring his side of the story. In many cases, he's not permitted to cross-examine the guard because of the feeling that this would in some way demean the guard. It would bring him down to the level of the inmate, that the inmate could ask questions of the guard. Other problems or other areas of intervention have included the ability to write letters, and the courts have now been willing to hold that inmates should be entitled to correspond with the courts and attorneys without censorship. They have concluded that if the institution is to censor written communications, there must be a purpose. Thus far, the courts have been unwilling to say that there is no purpose in censorship at all, or in limiting the number of persons to whom one can correspond. Other areas have included medical care. Some of the problems in the institutions, and particularly in jails, has been a lack of adequate medical care. the courts have been willing to intervene and assure that the, or at least to the limits of their ability, to assure that inmates are given adequate medical care. Additionally, the one of the most difficult problems to deal with, I think, recently, is the argument that in addition to justice, the inmate is entitled to opportunities to be rehabilitated. In mental institutions, the courts have in some limited instances been willing to intervene, and they've said, in effect, if you're holding someone because on the basis that he's mentally ill and that he is must be rehabilitated, he will be held until such time as he is rehabilitated, then obviously there's a corresponding obligation to do something to try to rehabilitate this person. And some attorneys are arguing that similarly there ought to be a right to rehabilitation among prison inmates. As we now know, many inmates are sentenced under indeterminate sentences. They can be in an institution for from 1 to 10 years. And the parole board intends to release them at such time as, in their judgment, they're entitled to return to the community. If that's the case, it seems apparent that the inmate is entitled to some efforts to put him in a condition so that he is entitled to return to the community. Yeah. The difficulty, of course, is that we really don't know what to do. The, a study was published recently which surveyed essentially, well, it was a summary of 18 major surveys which have been done in the corrections field in the last 25 years, and the author has sorted them out and abstracted those which he considered to be the most significant, the ones that were the most academically sound. And his conclusion, which is a rather dismal one, I think, is that nothing which was tried ever made any real substantial difference, no matter what it was. It's one of the commonplaces of the criminal justice thinking is that if we increase probation and parole services, that will decrease the recidivism, that the closer the supervision, the less crimes will be committed by those who are on probation or parole. He found that in a pilot project that didn't make a bit of difference. Similarly, we like to think that if we have vocational training in institutions, that the inmates will learn to work and will be employed upon being discharged. It hasn't made any difference there either. So, in summary, I can only say at this point that the least we can do, it seems to me, is achieve justice for the people that we subject to the system. Hopefully we can achieve rehabilitation. Unfortunately, at this point, I don't think we really know how to do that.
Mr. Matthews, would you like to have any replies to their comments?
Well, I would like to. I don't want to take much more of your time, but some things did occur to me. I'd first share with you a theory about correctional change, and then overlay on that a theory about people and their criminal justice system and its function of corrections within it, as far as they're concerned. One theory of correctional change that I'm not the only one that advanced is that it proceeds by crisis, as corrections is the most isolated part of the criminal justice system. Most people don't know anything about it. It is a lockup and is often even surrounded by walls, if not walls, fences that, practically speaking, keep the public out. Its defensive thrust, if you will, is oriented toward not getting in the papers, as Bob has told us, so that it is all, it's hidden from public view until they have a crisis, a riot, perhaps maybe a do-gooder society discovering terrible conditions, something that is put in the papers, and then public becomes indignant and corrections changes a little bit, one place at a time, or changes at least until it lapses again into isolation. But there is a theory of correctional change that fundamental change occurs in these spurts as a result of crisis, And so that what we need, really, for in order to improve the correction system is one hell of a bunch of big riots under that theory. Now, an overlay theory on this is that what do people use corrections for? I think they use it for as a whipping boy for the criminal justice conscience. We wouldn't dare attack a judge. It's interesting that the two reactors here are both focused on the correctional system. Quite frankly, it has its problems, but I don't think that's the problem with the criminal justice system. That's the most important problem with the criminal justice system. It is important any time men are brutalized, abused, or even treated in ways that are less than intelligent, even if kind. We cannot tolerate that. I feel very deeply about corrections, but I don't really think it's the problem with the criminal justice system. Not the cause of all the crime. Even the recidivists don't commit all the crime, although we might help some in that regard. Okay, what then is the problem? You know, I'd come back to the one that I'm glad that we have one little disagreement to make it more interesting, but say that people don't really want corrections to be rehabilitative. I'm not so sure of that. Those of you who read the recent bestseller, Papillon, about Henri Charrière and Devil's Island Escape, and you may have read other such stories. The French people tolerated Devil's Island and its accompanying prison colonies for long after the French people no longer believed in that they were any good, or the majority of the French people might have voted as at the time of Dreyfus, certainly, the French people would have voted to do away with Devil's Island, I'm sure. The question was never put to them. It was a part of a system that was protected by the bureaucracy in just the way that Machiavelli said it was. It was also justified by the sanctity of the law. And when did law ever get to be that sanctimonious, really, in our lives? Law is a creature of people, and we can change law. The thrust of the criminal law in this country is to punish. That's why I think many corrections people and the bureaucratic system of criminal justice tend to protect its courts, its institutions, and its law from encroachment. I'm not sure that people really believe that. The Harris poll that was taken at the time of the 1967 indicated the majority, some 53% of the people, did believe, correct, that prisons were for rehabilitation rather than for punishment. Now, to be sure, I don't know that they knew what they were saying. But there has been a shift in public opinion. There is, in fact, a kind of unwillingness of the bureaucracy and the system to yield to public opinion. Law, I think, is the bastion here. Now, how do we get... People do make laws, don't they? I don't know. Lawmakers make laws, and lawmakers, by and large, are a kind of median of public intelligence, and maybe even below the median. We have failed in many times to, we have failed, those of us who are involved, have failed as professionals to speak out and make our voices heard as experts. As a matter of fact, the lawmaker plays oftentimes to the least intelligent portion of his voting community, because, in fact, it is the portion that can be channeled and that will vote in a predictable manner. It's also true, just as with gun legislation, those who are a majority of people would outlaw handguns tomorrow. A small minority of people will keep us from doing it because they speak more loudly, if less intelligently. I think the same thing's true with lawmakers. And what we need to do is to demand that our lawmakers listen two experts who have studied the problem, and that experts who have studied the problem speak out and demand that they be heard, and that those who are in the system not be quite so wary about attacking the system, because it isn't all good. It needs to be changed. The law needs to be changed. And I think that's the crucial thing. Just one final note. I suspect that as a result of this change, one of the things that might come out is the right not to be rehabilitated. Both the Danish and the Netherlands criminal codes, and the correctional code included, incidentally, which is another interesting thing, most of our codes are separate. With one code of criminal code and one code of correction, and yet the one controls the other effectively. But they're combined in Scandinavia. Both of these codes begin with a preamble that I can't repeat exactly for you, but it goes something like this. That we hold that the sanction of the criminal law and the power of the government through the correctional system shall only be used insofar as it is helpful in rehabilitating the individual or bringing the individual back into a useful role in society. That shall only be used to that extent and no more, regardless of what the sentence is. So you get many indeterminate sentences. One, Netherlands is the size of Illinois, which means it's 2+ or 3 times the size of Missouri. And they have no women's institution. They have no women in a prison. And they only have 1,400 men in prison in the entire country. They have practically no people in jail, and yet they have about 10 times as many people on probation, much of which supervision is performed by volunteers, every cell visited by a member of the community as a prison visitor on a regular basis, maintaining open contact, very few people in institutions, period. We make far too much use of maximum security institutions, of big institutions. We need so that many changes are possible, but I think we must focus on the use of experts, on public opinion, and on the bastion of the law. I wanted to say in a similar vein that it seems to me that although I've described the role of the court in some way regulating the discretion or activities of prison administrators, it seems to me that it's obvious that the court will not be able to really make a substantial change in the way corrections are operated. And I agree with Dr. Matthews that perhaps in the long run, what we should look for is not so much to expect penal institutions to reform people, but rather to try to keep people out of penal institutions. And for those who are in penal institutions, bring some element of justice, and perhaps that's the best we can do.
I'd like to respond to that concept of justice. A textbook definition, I understand, I can relate to it, but when I take the textbook definitions, which we've all referred to up here this morning, and try to operationalize them, I find this is where I get into trouble. It's not unusual. I can give you some statistics of our local area where your campus is located, St. Louis County. Some 600 cases last year that were handled by the public defender's office, and I would say a very competent public defender's office. 15 cases went to trial. The rest were plea bargains. Out of some 600 cases that were handled. This is not unusual. This is not peculiar to St. Louis County, nor is it peculiar to Missouri. But rather, I think if you look across the nation, you'll find that most justice is done on a plea bargaining. This week and last week, I've sent 9 people to the penitentiary that have been through the justice system, through the court. Let me pull out 3 cases and tell you that one was in pretrial confinement for in excess of 900 days while the justice system was trying to determine justice. Another was in pretrial confinement for 688 days. and another was in pretrial confinement for 490 days. The man in pretrial confinement for 490 days was there for over 100 days waiting for his attorney, who had 43 continuances, to argue one motion before the judge. So I think, you know, in terms of justice, of the delivery of justice, we've got a lot of areas to look at and a lot of things, you know, to be concerned with. I completely support the idea that the best way to get this system to work is to get people and keep people out of institutions. One thing the justice system has failed to do is look at who really belongs in a jail. Last year in San Luis County, we released 2,000 people on their own recognizance. Now, if we hadn't had a recognizance program because our judges were willing to interpret the law, Missouri, by the way, does not have a recognizance law, although the bill for our recognizance law is now on the governor's desk awaiting signature. But we've been using recognizance in St. Louis County since 1967 because our judges so interpreted the law. Out of those 2,000 people, only one was rearrested while he was out in the community, and only 2% failed to show up for court. Now, in terms of risk management, in terms of cost to the citizen, this is far less cost in terms of safety and tax dollars than if you have kept all these people locked up waiting for the overcrowded, overburdened justice system to work anyway. In all of St. Louis County, and we serve a square mile population of 495 square miles with over a million population, we only have, as of this morning, 135 people in confinement. And out of that 135 people, only 20 are sentenced. When you look at other systems, well, our neighbors, the city of St. Louis, serving less than a million people, we have 900 in pretrial confinement, and 400 of them are sentenced. And, you know, I really say that I can't accept that as being necessary, because a lot of those 400 are skid row alcoholics and are victimless crimes and other people that, you know, their only problem is either stupidity or disadvantage, and by no means should they be in the justice system.